Pico Iyer, I got to say, until I read this marvelous book of yours, I didn't appreciate the depth of all the paradoxes around the Dalai Lama. This chief of state, who's also an exile, at the core of it, it seems to me that it's the puzzle of a man who is the most anti-tribal, universal champion of a spirit vastly beyond us, who is at the same time implicated in this very particular piece of national and geographical struggle in the world today. Take us into some of the infinite complexities of this man's head.
Well, the heart of the paradox, as you so wonderfully said, is that he is church and state in one. I think he's the only de facto head of state in the world who's also a monk. And I think that is also the possibility he represents, that he brings to the world of realpolitik the much more spacious and selfless vision of a monk and the stillness and concentration of a monk, at the same time as he's the rare monk who refuses to hold to anything that has been disproved by science. You know, another of his identities is as amateur scientist and full-time empiricist, who, as a religious figure, says that as soon as science comes along and proves that the moon and sun are not equidistant from the earth, throw out the old Tibetan mandalas that take poetic license and show them as such. What is interesting to me is that he's not just monk, head of state, head of a school of Buddhism, amateur scientist, and regular guy, but he's pushing all those roles together to see how each one can open up or light up the others. And what comes out of all that is he's the rare religious leader, as your question suggests, who tells people not to get needlessly confused or distracted by religion. He's the, I think, even rarer Buddhist who, as he travels around the world, urges Westerners not to take up Buddhism, but to learn anything they can from the techniques that Buddhism has developed and bring them into their own traditions where their roots are deepest. And he's perhaps the rarest of Tibetans who says that Tibet, in small part, was responsible for its predicament. So, as you say, he doesn't fit in any of the categories, and he's always challenging himself in his own positions and trying to, I suppose, move to that place beyond religious or regional distinctions to something shared and human.
He fits one great big category that I'm always looking for, which is to say the non-tribal religious figure, a person for whom religion would never be allowed to start a war or create hostility or feel any passion against another person at all. I mean, zero. He's non-dogmatic. He is scientific. I learned that in a funny way because we were interviewing him. He was in Houston, and it turned out that our interview conflicted with a rocket launch that he wanted to see. There was no question where he was going to be. And he left right smack in the middle without a by your leave or anything. Is this a paradox, though, this non-tribal religion, or is it the ultimate truth?
I think non-tribal is a wonderful way to say it. Inclusive is another word I think of in his context. And I think it's the mode of the coming century. And I suppose, you know, one reason I wanted to write this book was I felt that especially at the dawn of this new millennium, in the wake of, say, the terrorist attacks in this country, on the one hand, people seem to be more horrified and appalled than ever by what could be done in the name of religion, more disenchanted with religion than ever before, as we've seen in the new atheisms that have come up. And yet at the same time, the suffering and the horror of the terrorist attacks was propelling people towards precisely the kind of guidance and wisdom that religion traditionally offered. In other words, people were hungering for religious solace and yet disenchanted with religion. And so in that context, a religious figure who's speaking about something different than religion or wider than religion seemed to me a possibly liberating and tonic figure. And just as you say, I think some people are surprised to know that the official head of Tibetan Buddhism has written whole books on the Gospels based on lectures he delivered to Christians in London, calls himself a defender of Islam, and as you at the Rocket found out, spends much of his time with scientists who probably proudly call themselves atheists. And so I think, I remember 20 years ago talking to an interviewer, he said, let's not talk about religions. We've got too many religions already. Let's talk about something human. And I think he's aware of the way religions and even complex texts or philosophical arguments can obstruct us from our fundamental responsibilities just towards our neighbors, and we lose sight of what's much more immediate and practical in the religious ether, as it were.
We've got to get back to Tibet, But stick with where you're going. One of the striking things in your book, if I may say, seems to me the affinity with the greatest American writers, Thoreau, Emerson, William James, but others, including Thomas Merton, other non-dogmatic seekers of the profoundest energy. This business of religion without dogma is William James's life. The idea of Christianity without miracles is sort of Emerson's life. Is that real or just apparent, this sort of Emersonian Buddhism or Buddhist Emersonianism?
Well, I'm thrilled you say that and notice it. Indeed, the title of the book, The Open Road, it's Walt Whitman's phrase, and I was citing D.H. Lawrence's riffing on Walt Whitman. And I chose it very scrupulously to try to take the Dalai Lama out of what may seem a very foreign, far-off, exotic practice of Buddhism and bring him right into the heart of America, because I think those correspondences are very, very real. And it's easy to forget that Thoreau, for example, supervised the first translation of the Lotus Sutra into English. The way that Buddhism came into the American and English language was through Thoreau in the Dial magazine in 1844. So it's no coincidence. I was spending a couple of days 2 weeks ago, much after my book came out, just reading through Emerson and Thoreau, and every other sentence seemed to chime with what the Dalai Lama and what Buddhism says. And I suppose what they were doing was in some ways bringing certain Buddhist principles into the American grain and into an American creed of transcendentalism and optimism. And so if somebody were to ask me what my religion was, I couldn't call myself a Buddhist because I haven't put in the hard work to be a Buddhist, but I would gladly like to call myself a transcendentalist, because bringing those Eastern philosophies into a Western context is one of the great things that they did. And interestingly, it goes back to our earlier question. One of the correspondences I found was that the Dalai Lama, everywhere he travels, comes and says, "I'm just a regular guy. And the reason I'm here and the reason you may listen to me is that I'm showing you what any regular guy can do." And people listen to him and say, "He's superhuman. He's a god." In other words, they completely throw out everything he's been saying, refuse to listen to him. I just read Emerson on Jesus, of all things, in a very different context. And he says, "Christ talks about the greatness of man, and we hear only the greatness of Christ." I mean, I couldn't think of a better way of synopsizing the Dalai Lama's predicament. That's just a description of his life. But in terms of his philosophy, Emerson, with, I think, his stress on constant flux, everything is in permanent movement. We can't know what is going to happen tomorrow, but we have to be ready and ripe to seize whatever opportunities come along. To me, as a non-Buddhist, that's a very fundamental part of Buddhism, impermanence as a locus of opportunity in some ways. And so, as you saw, I deliberately begin the book with Thoreau. I end the book with Emerson, and I have William James making many cameo appearances, because as I was writing this book, I was reading Robert Richardson's transcendent biography of William James, and again making correspondences. And one of the things I liked about James, well, one was that I think the phrase radical empiricism is used of James, and that's a perfect description of Emerson. But the other thing that appealed to me in James was that in the 1890s, I believe, you know, he was always a scientist, and all his training was in science, and yet, as you say, he was committed to a kind of open-mindedness, that science wasn't for him a way of limiting the world, but of seeing everything the world was capable of. And I was so struck that when he was researching mediums and other things that he thought were totally flaky, the scientific part of him forced him to be open-minded and empirical. He conducted investigations, and almost to his horror, he found, well, there's something here I can't explain, which isn't to say they're genuine, but I can't say they're fake. And that degree of rigor and open-mindedness, which I think is the James combination, fits the Dalai Lama to a T. If William James was sitting in Cambridge now, the Dalai Lama might even give up the rocket launch in order to go and talk to him, I think.
I'm sure he would. What sticks in my mind is Robert Richardson saying, I don't know that he put it in his book, but that William James, somebody observed, his first impulse on entering a laboratory and seeing a beaker with a fluid in it was to pick it up and taste it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At whatever risk, yes, to mind or body. But again, these Emersonian notions, the infinitude of the private man, the universality of spirit, the notion that once we've read Plato, we are Plato. There is a democratic access to universal energy, to God. It's all Dalai Lama, or vice versa. Here's a digression, but you know, there are people like me, maybe you, who with that kind of Emersonian reading see transcendentalism everywhere. I see it in the internet, the notion of a universal mind, of a universal connectedness of the species, of a kind of equality of curiosity around the world and discovery. It's very much kind of underlying the place we are in the world, I think.
Yes, and no coincidence, the Dalai Lama has actually written an introduction to a book on the internet, because I think the core of his thinking is connectedness, this notion of interdependence, which in fact in old Buddhist thought was called Indra's net. I mean, almost sounds like internet. And again, just exactly the same as Emerson. And what you described in Emerson so beautifully, I think, fits to a T, to a syllable. The Buddhist notion, principally, that everyone is a potential Buddha. And the notion of potential and the notion, if you can call it the divinity of man or just the greatness of man, that we have a much greater breadth and possibility than we surmise. I think that's the heart of Emerson, and perhaps it was reinforced in Emerson from Buddhism, because I think that's the core of Buddhism. So the Dalai Lama rejoices in everything that opens channels of communication between bodies. And of course, that's why he has held out so strongly against a boycott of the Olympics. Many Tibetans and many people across the globe, horrified by China's treatment of Tibet right now, are saying, let's boycott the Olympics. And the Dalai Lama is unusually the rare person who cares with every breath about the Tibetans, but says, we can't boycott it, because to isolate China is to prompt China to demonize us, to create abstractions in our in its head instead of encountering the human reality of us. He mentioned to me over our 30 years of conversation that our greatest mistake, he said, in old Tibet, our worst mistake was being too isolated from the world, and he feels that Tibet really paid the consequences of it. So in that sense, global networks, communications of any kind, the opportunity he has had to come to talk to you and see what you and he have in common, and then to go to the rocket launch and see what he can take back to the Tibetans, that's, I think, at the core of his particular life and his seizing the global moment in a way, because, of course, no Dalai Lama before him had been out of Asia, had been on a plane, had come to the U.S., and he has done those partly to bring his message, partly to learn from the U.S., but also to remind both parties of how much their destinies are intertwined. And I've written, as you know, a lot about globalism, and the higher form of globalism I've always thought is Emerson, the Oversoul, universalism. And that's why I chose to write a book about the Dalai Lama, because he's taking globalism, but not at the level of Microsoft, McDonald's, or Britney Spears, but at the level of conscience, imagination, and the heart, the much more fundamental forms of globalism.
Pico Iyer, I'm trying to use your book as a way, in a sense, to rehearse this coming year of the Olympics in China, the protests in Tibet, the pressure on Dalai Lama that's going to be in our news, you know, as far as the eye can see. How does the Dalai Lama, who plays everything in a very subtle and imaginative, global, patient way, how can he guide us through the news, so to speak?
Well, I think already he's been constantly reminding us, and even more Tibetans in Tibet and around him, to speak out but not to lash out, to fervently support Tibetans' needs for basic freedoms of speech and thought, but not in that process to demonize the Chinese. I think one great thing he's doing is to remind us that no solution of the Tibetan problem is possible without taking into account the Chinese all around. For example, in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa, the majority of the people now are Han Chinese. So even once Tibetan rights are rightfully restored, you can't undo what has happened already, and you can't ignore the fact that Tibet and China are neighbors. And I think that's one reason why, as you said, he speaks for patience and forbearance and not for violence. Because in any neighborhood, if your neighbor is irking or oppressing you, if you throw a rock through his window, probably it's going to lead to terrible consequences for you, but it's also going to poison or shadow your relationship for the foreseeable future, because he's always going to be there and you're always going to be here. And to antagonize him is to set off repercussions that are going to go on and on and on. And that's why the only way to begin to resolve the situation is to try to speak peacefully to him and to his best side and to remind him of all you have in common. And I think one reason that the Dalai Lama is counseling Tibetans not to be too violent in their protests or defiance is that he knows that China will only come down harder on them, and people who have suffered a lot will only suffer much more. And I think, as your question suggests, one thing it's easy for us to forget is that within the whole Tibetan community, the one person who really knows China is, in fact, the Dalai Lama, because he's been dealing with them day in, day out for 59 years, since the time of Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. He traveled across China for a year in 1954 over his people's objections, spent time in Beijing. He has a brother who was married to a Chinese woman and speaks fluent Chinese. In other words, he has, as you said, a keen and attentive sense of what will and will not work in dealing with the Chinese. China's leadership has traditionally been prideful. There are strong issues of face. They haven't taken well to outsiders telling them what to do. And so I think he realizes that to prick their pride is only to bring down even greater hardship from them, that you have to work with them and you have to be sensitive to their particular needs. At the same time, he's wonderfully never backed down from unequivocally saying you've got to change your attitude to Tibet. And he says, the last time I saw him, which was 4 months ago, I was traveling across Japan with him, and he said, well, President Hu Jintao has a slogan now, which is harmonious society. I fully support that, he said, but harmony doesn't come at the barrel of a gun. And one of the other things that I think is most important about his vision of Tibet and China, and I think he would always put them together, is that maybe for 15 years now, when I talk to him, he's always stressed that he doesn't expect the Chinese government to come to its senses overnight, though it might happen the way it happened with the Berlin Wall and apartheid and other sudden changes in the world. But he has great faith in Chinese individuals slowly becoming aware of how much they have in common with the Tibetans, starting with the fact that they're suffering under a very dictatorial government too. And when he said this about 15 years ago, I thought, well, this is quixotic. It's the kind of thing he has to say because things are not going in his way. You know, the journalist in me raised that skeptical objection, at least to myself. But what I've noticed in recent times is more and more Chinese are speaking out on behalf of Tibet. And to me, the most startling event of the spring was not the demonstrations, which to some extent were expected, but the fact that 29 leading Chinese writers and intellectuals actually released a petition aimed at their government saying, talk to the Dalai Lama, stop suppression in Tibet, and introduce an outside investigating body to find out what has really happened in Tibet. So I think all of us would know that Tibetans would risk their lives on behalf of Tibet. But who would guess that regular Chinese people would put their names down on a petition and that Chinese would be risking their lives on behalf of Tibet, which is a remarkable thing and is one of the things that I think the Dalai Lama has been counting on all along. And it's especially important because the other thing that he's been stressing is the world's attention is turned to China now. China will be on its best behavior in the months leading up to the Olympic Games. What's really critical is what happens after the Olympics, when we all think, we'll probably be thinking about the November election here and Iraq and other things. We'll have forgotten largely about China and Tibet. And that is when the worst kind of things could happen. And that is when, ideally, we should be as vigilant as possible.
So much and so many different things are at stake around Tibet, and I wish you'd just sort them out in his mind. The part that puzzles me, we know he's in some degree a Tibetan nationalist and who identifies obviously with the spiritual, meditative, monkish tradition of Tibet. Where does he stand on the very question of modern values as represented in this fight, even design issues, tradition? What appears to us in China from a distance as a kind of crass rush to absolute, almost faceless modernity. Mm-hmm. The Dalai Lama, as you say, is a modernist in many ways, a realist, mm-hmm. a rationalist, a scientist. What is it he wants to preserve or would fight to preserve under the name of Tibet?
He's classically clear-sighted on that. And I think as a monk, he has a great gift for sifting the essence from the surface. So he says that a lot of old Tibetan forms and traditions, whatever, they should be thrown out. They're not suited to the modern world. Tibet doesn't need them anymore. They're just like old clothes. You've got used to them, old habits. You've had them for 50 years, but you don't necessarily need them, and they may impede you. At the same time, he says that deeper than that, there are certain values that Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism generated and discovered over centuries, and that is the core of Tibet. And that is a part of Tibet that can be sustained in exile, that should be sustained, and that can be kept going regardless of what's happening to that entity on the map known as Tibet.
I interrupt just to wonder if that even makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you're for the modern world, why not just get on the Chinese train? It's roaring along into the future, defining the future, and say, we're Chinese now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you say that, because in the matter of the train, the new high-speed train that started 2 years ago to link Lhasa to China and other to Beijing and other Chinese cities, all the Tibetans, most Tibetans are bemoaning it. The Chinese are saying it's a great sign of prosperity and development. And the Dalai Lama says it's neither. The train itself is neither good nor bad. And it's the same kind of thing that Thoreau or Emerson would say, actually. He says it's only as good as the compassionate uses to which it can be put. And he said it could be a great bringer of good. And the last time I saw him in Japan last November, he kept on saying that Tibet is a poor country. It's materially backward. It needs to be a part of China precisely because China is bringing material development and modernity. And he says both of those are good things that Tibet needs and Tibet is grateful for. And Tibet, that's one reason why he doesn't want Tibet to be independent from China, because he realizes that there are severe deficiencies that China has, for whatever reasons, helped to address. It's just that what's being lost in the process of bringing that, as you said, rush to modern development. But it's interesting, people often ask him, his old home, the Potala Palace, the symbol of Lhasa, is surrounded by discos and karaoke parlors. And people often say, how do you feel to see this great Tibetan and Buddhist monument mockingly surrounded by an amusement park? He says, no problem, fine, that's okay. That's the way things are. We don't need to waste our time and energy thinking about that, but let's address, you know, my people's needs for food and for freedom. That's fundamental. Doesn't matter if there's a disco there.
This is hilariously funny, actually, the train connection. Thoreau, when he was writing Walden, observed that they were just finishing a train between Boston and Fitchburg, and he said he was totally against it. He said, I can walk to Fitchburg or Boston faster than I could go to either one and get on the train to the other place. It begins to occur to me that Thoreau might be, with the Tibetans, a localist. Emerson, on the other hand, who was global, might be arguing with Thoreau about this. Thoreau, I think, would be saying, Tibet for the Tibetans. They know each other best, and there's nothing to be gained. When they completed the almost transcontinental cable from Maine to Texas, Thoreau's question was, does Maine have anything to say to Texas? He would have preferred the Tibetan conversation, I think. Emerson would have said, no, it's a big, wonderful world, and we're one species.
This is great material to talk about. We could have a wonderful four-hour conversation on this, because I also remember that moment. I mean, that to me, Thoreau was a secular monk, and what he did by essentially meditating on and in Walden Pond, taking himself into seclusion, was again cut through the surface of the world and see what is deep down. And in that, those are ways in which he chimes exactly with the Dalai Lama in the ways I was describing. And what I remember from that sequence is him saying, well, now we have great means to communicate with one another, but what are we going to communicate? In other words, all that the internet is a terrific way of connectedness, but if we're just going to say, hi, did you hear about Britney Spears, it's not bringing us forward at all. So we have to go again to the root and the essence, which I think is the Dalai Lama's point. And I think in some ways, the notion you throw out is a very stimulating and provocative one. I think the other thing that hits me about Thoreau is, of course, he was reading Hindu thinkers and Persians and ancient Greeks and the rest, and in that sense, at least, was a universalist. But in terms of the Dalai Lama, certainly as a political leader, having to bring all this into the real world, as you said, he's super practical and very, very realist. And I will say, as a coda to what I was saying before, that the last time I flew into Lhasa, the plane was 90% Chinese. Most of the Chinese were going there for economic opportunities. A few were going as tourists to enjoy the picturesque sites. But a few Chinese were actually going to make offerings at the central temple to find Tibetan lamas and to learn about Tibetan Buddhism, because, of course, they have been officially denied any religion for 50 years, and they, more than anyone in Boston, Australia, or Paris, crying out for some kind of religious guidance. And in that way, the Dalai Lama's gamble has paid off. When I traveled with him for this week in Japan in November, we walked at one point into a room in Yokohama, and there were about 60 people there. It was a conference room in high up in a hotel. And as soon as he walked into the room, all the people began sobbing. And they started prostrating themselves on the floor. And while he talked about Buddhism, they sat on the floor, although there were chairs laid out for them. And when he finished talking, they all clustered around him, grabbing at him just to get his blessing. And every one of those 60 people was a Han Chinese from the People's Republic of China, responding to him exactly the way Tibetans do. So it's a very slow process, but I think day by day, person by person, more and more Chinese are actually, on an individual level, making connections with Tibet. And I think those of us who care about Tibet in the months leading up to the Olympics want to make sure that we don't stigmatize, demonize, or alienate the many Chinese who are rallying behind that cause.
Pico, if the Dalai Lama and Tibetans sort of cast off the old, the meaningless, the unmodern, what remains as the living core, the values? What is left?
I think those are the values that Tibetan monks, blessed by their isolation, for hundreds of years, their philosophers were able to investigate the mind and the properties of the mind and what projection and delusion and all those things are about. If the Dalai Lama were here, the first thing he'd say was compassion. Universal value, of course, but Tibetans grew up very close to the environment and learned to take care of it. What I would say is one of the great things he offers is that you change the world by changing the way you think of the world, the changing the way you look at the world. As with exile, you or I reflexively think of it as a bad thing, but we can choose to think of it as a possibility, and if we make that choice, we can get much more out of it. And the same with any of our circumstances. One of the other things that he's given me, and I think would be a core value, has to do with going to the roots and not being distracted by the external. For example, I think he would say, I hear him implicitly saying, that a peace treaty that's drawn up by people who are still territorial or defensive or jealous is not worth the paper it's written about. And that's why you have to start changing yourself. In other words, if in the Middle East or in China or in Tibet, they dutifully say, we promise peace, but their hearts are still unquiet, as soon as they're angry again, that they'll be back to their own habits. So you have to begin the reform deep down and only really in the self, which is, takes us back to Emerson and Thoreau. That's where the transformation has to come. And once it comes, then it's out in the world, and the world has a better chance of enduring solutions.
Do his own values by now, I mean, he's a world traveler, a celebrity, do his values diverge from those of ordinary Tibetans? They must.
I would say they diverge only in depth. His values have not changed at all. And I know that because my father met him in 1960 and wrote a full account of that meeting. And I've been reading it a lot in recent times. And I notice everything the Dalai Lama said 48 years ago at the age of 25 is word for word what he would say now, because his principles are so deeply founded in Buddhism. The main difference between him and his people, I think, is just that he's a monk and they're not. So they share this common pool of, broadly speaking, Tibetan Buddhist values having to do with compassion and interconnectedness and responsibility, but he meditates 7-8 hours a day and so incarnates and has made those the root of his being, and they are normal believers who, for whom those are what they think about when they go to their temples and try to think about the rest of the time, but can't always bear in mind. So I think it's the same difference as between Desmond Tutu and the South Africans, or the leading spiritual figure in this area and all the rest of his flock, who are listening to him, trying to heed him, but don't have the chance to lead that life every moment the way a man of officially a religious spirit and a monk has to do.
In terms of that long-term planning on which you quote him, he says about our war in Iraq 2008, there must be some deep seeds of unwisdom here. And of course there are, going back at least to World War I and the British rule. How much does that help us?
Well, it's part of his unorthodox and I think revolutionary way of thinking. He's been talking a lot. Everywhere he goes, people ask him about the Iraq War, and he says just what you said, that he says the roots of this may go back even as deeply as the 19th century. And so it's going to be hard to solve because this situation has been in place one way or another for, let's say, 120 years. But he says flip that over. That means that what we do now is going to have a significant effect 120 years from now. And that's precisely why he believes in farsightedness and a particular sense of responsibility. And one of the, I think, saving graces of the Dalai Lama, or beautiful qualities of the Dalai Lama, is that he's realistic about those values himself. 12 years ago, he told me, well, looked at from one perspective, my policy of maximum concessions has achieved nothing. The more I've extended the hand of friendship to China, the more China has cracked down on Tibet harder and harder. And I think he would say, what he's been saying, what he always says a lot, is all we can do is try our best and not capitulate to lesser strategies. But we also have to accept that the fruits of our efforts may not come in our lifetime, may not come in this century. And of course, it's very hard for all of us as human beings to accept that what we do may not even benefit our grandchildren's grandchildren. He is thinking in those terms. But for us, it's difficult, and that's why many Tibetans in exile feel we can't sit by any longer and see our country torn apart. We've got to intervene now. And that's why his counsel to patients, which I think is a fundamentally extremely sound and careful one, nonetheless is difficult for many of us to hear. Buddhists believe in karma, which is an extremely complicated, intricate latticework of cause and effect, crisscrossing the world and crisscrossing the centuries, which means that the smallest act now has consequences we couldn't imagine, maybe across the world now, but certainly several years from now. So he takes the Iraq example as precisely a reminder of acting carefully now. Terrible things may happen now around us, and as with his policy, there may be no visible effect. But if we try to act with pure motivation now, 120 years from now, there won't be an Iraq. Things will be working out better. I've never heard anyone say that about the Iraq situation, but he is such a master logician. In his form of Buddhism, the main practice is debating, seeing things from every side. I take a position, then I take the opposite position. And so you'll notice when he comes and speaks in New England, say, his favorite words are investigate, analyze, research, and explore. He frames everything always in almost like a syllogism in terms of logic. This is A, this is A, this is B, therefore C. And so he looks at Iraq and says, terrible situation now, caused by bad situation before, make good situation now, and it'll make good situation in the future. That kind of thing. I'm unfortunately simplifying. He would do it much better, but that's the best I can do for now.
May I say, you're my model of global curiosity and a certain universal familiarity with the scene. You go everywhere. You write beautifully about everything, starting for me with Cuba. And your model in the Dalai Lama is an apostle of this universal spirit and consciousness. Are they working? Can this universal responsibility that the Dalai Lama embodies beat back the narrowness of religious practice and religious warfare that is engulfing us?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think the more internationalism there is in the world, as it were, the more nationalism there is. And we've seen both impulses at work, let's say, since 1990 when the Berlin Wall came down. In some ways, more and more people are choosing to embrace the possibilities of a borderless world. But also, others faced with that are retreating into tribes. And I think in the 15th century, an Arab poet said, if you put human beings into a desert where there are no walls, the first thing they do is create walls and just cluster themselves into groups. So you're right. I don't think it will ever triumph enormously. And globalism, like the internet or any new opportunity, is only as good as human beings are, and we're all imperfect and mixed. But one of the things that surprised me, and one of the things that I try to catch in this book, is, as you said so beautifully, he's an apostle of a movement that has many, many other spokesmen. And what strikes me is that we now have a presidential candidate in this country who's saying exactly the same thing. Let's forget about the old polarities, throw out the old categories. Let's not think in black and white terms in all senses. Let's remember that many Republicans do a lot of things that look democratic, and a lot of Democrats do things that Republicans, and let's free ourselves from those old divisions that are only making everyone feel out of sorts and alienated. Two of the people I concentrate in The Open Road on are two of the Dalai Lama's great friends and admirers, but also colleagues, Vaclav Havel and Desmond Tutu. Desmond Tutu came to my hometown a couple of years ago, and somebody asked him, is there anything we should know? What do you want to leave us with? And he said, God is not a Christian. This is a great thing for a lifelong man of the Christian cloth. Vaclav Havel, from the day he became president of Czechoslovakia, said, the most important thing is not to think of my country, my community, my family. We have to expand to a larger vision. One of the other things I did in researching this book on the Dalai Lama was actually to follow U2, the rock group around the world, because I think Bono has spoken as eloquently as anyone about the possibilities and responsibilities of a global neighborhood, and said, look, a villager in Africa, a kid in the slums of Dakar, is as much our community as somebody in Newton or living across the freeway in LA. And he's right these days. And not everyone's going to heed that message. But Bill Clinton's last book was on global giving, on working out of those ideas of Bono. So what has struck me is that more and more of these very powerful figures in the public domain have been embracing this idea. And the last one I'll leave us with is perhaps the most unexpected, which is Bill Gates, who, having devoted all that ingenuity to making money for his company, is now devoting that same resourcefulness to disseminating it around the world. And in some ways to say, my family is not so much Microsoft as the global community. And if he even says that with 10% of his being, that's a great benefit for everyone.
Not to forget Jimmy Carter, who tries to think globally, takes his lumps for it now and then, but is doing his bit. Does it help or not for us as Americans to see China and Tibet as a kind of reenactment of our own manifest destiny? Our war with Mexico, not a pretty story. The wiping out of the Native Americans, a very ugly and almost unknown chapter of our own present history. Is that what's going on in China and Tibet?
It's very, very similar. It's hard not to entertain that comparison when you go to Lhasa. The Chinese have traditionally thought of the Tibetans as barbarians. They still use that word for the Tibetans. They think of them as a backward, nomadic, wild people who are attuned perhaps to the heavens and the elements, but have no sense of civilization. That's wrong, but that's the way they think of it, and they have obliterated them in that spirit. So it's very, very similar to what's happening here. What's interesting, again, is now more and more Chinese writers and thinkers, the way it has happened in this country, are suddenly saying that's not fair. And, you know, what's taking us to Tibet and our fascination is that they know all kinds of things that we as Chinese do not. And so the balance is being redressed. But you're absolutely right. In terms of, for us in America, perhaps it's useful to see the parallels and to think in those terms, but also to realize that most Chinese individuals now think of Tibet probably more as Alaska. It's a far out, difficult, inhospitable terrain, but that's also a potential gold mine where they can get jobs and make a lot of money. A difficult place, very different because of physically different from the world that they know, but a new frontier for them to visit. So that's all useful, though I think the most useful thing that we as Americans can think of is for our governments to use this golden opportunity when China needs the approval of the world for the next 5 months, for our leaders in this country and elsewhere to continue to urge Chinese leaders, at least to talk to the Dalai Lama, just to talk to him, no more than that. And the assumption is all they have to do is get in the same room as him and something good will come out of that. And both President Clinton and President Bush have told Chinese leaders that. And for we, in just regular human beings in America, to be conscious of what's going on there and to be aware that one of the good things of the new century is we can follow events in Tibet, and in that sense, they are as close to us as what's going on the other side of Providence or Boston, and that they what happens there is going to affect us, and what we do can positively or negatively affect that. And also, just as a parenthesis, Jimmy Carter is in fact one of the Dalai Lama's greatest friends and heroes, and I think has talked a lot to him about how best to operate in the world. So in fact, Jimmy Carter, Desmond Tutu, and Vaclav Havel, all of them Christians to some degree, have been the great unofficial counselors to this Buddhist.
Would you speak just a little bit about yourself as a global traveler and writer? Mm-hmm. Indian blood, Oxford education, you lived long in America, worked for Time magazine, live in Japan. The world has become your oyster. Is there a price for that? You do it so elegantly.
Thank you. And there is a price for that, which is the possibility of rootlessness, the possibility of having many homes in many places, but none deep down. The Indians say it's much better, and I think Tibetans also, it's much better to dig a well 60 foot deep than 10 wells 6 feet deep. And I think that's true. And, you know, that's probably one of the invisible reasons that drew me towards this man and what he's up to and moved me to write this book. Because one of the things that my example is not so interesting, except that it speaks for so many people. I think the people of the new century are people like me with pieces of ourselves in many different cultures who have to address how do we create a community of tradition, a self and a home, given that, as you said, I have Indian features and an English voice and an American passport and live in Japan. And I think the answer is that you have to create a home inside yourself made up of your values or your affinities, your attachments, that in some sense is with you wherever you are, whether you're in one of those places or somewhere distant. And I think the Dalai Lama is one of the great paradigms of that because, remember, he spent the majority of his life in exile, surrounded by his own people who are also in exile. And what he has done, I think for most people, exile, the very word means sadness or disruption or loss. He has said exile is opportunity. And so as soon as he came into exile in India in 1959, the first words he shared with his younger brother, now we're free. Exile allows us to throw out what was outdated or stifling in old Tibet, to incorporate many new things. For example, women can do much more in the Tibetan community now than they could in old Tibet. Science has been added to the monastic curriculum. As you were saying before, he's created a whole democracy and a government in exile with its own parliament and constitution and prime minister. Tibet never had that before. And so for him, he's realized that exile will allow him to make a much better, new, improved kind of Tibet 2.1, provided his people can keep that notion that Tibet is not a place in the world. It's a cluster of values inside the imagination or soul. And I think some of them have and probably some of them haven't. But the beauty of that example is that many people would say this is the age of the exile. By some counts, there are as many as 100 million exiles in the world. And so what he's done, I've spent three of the last five springs in Dharamsala seeing how he's taken these people who didn't speak English, knew nothing about the outside world, never had lived at lower than 12,000 feet before, and somehow created a very strong community for them, whereby they're now a firm, full part of the global neighborhood. But so he's done a great service for the Tibetans, and they've worked hard to make it work. But more important than that is he's offering an example to Palestinians or Kurds or Uyghurs or you, or me, well, maybe not you, but me and many of the people I see around me in the streets in New England who are Indians who grew up in Iowa and have a Swedish boyfriend and are thinking, where do I belong? And I think he's offering all those people, whom I've called global souls, a better and a clearer way of thinking about those fundamental things like belonging and identity.
Pico Iyer, you give us a clearer way to think about it all. Thank you so much. It's a huge privilege and pleasure to hear you on Open Source.
It's really fun to talk to you again, and I wish we could have a six-hour conversation.
Thank you.